This podcast is intended for investment professionals only. All investing involves risk.
Geopolitical conflict, energy uncertainty, surprise policy moves. The headlines never stop. But how much should uncertainty actually impact investment decisions? We're recording this 2 weeks into the Middle East conflict, and while we're not here to predict how it's going to unfold, we're going to challenge the assumption that uncertainty is the enemy. We'll discuss how even amid market shocks, a consistent and level-headed framework can impose investment discipline and how all that translates to clients. This is LNG Talks. I'm Sharka Hallis, content manager. With me are Chris Jeffrey, co-head of asset allocation and head of macro, and fund managers Amy Boquet and Chris Teschmacher. Welcome, all of you. Before we get into it, I'd like to make it personal. What's one moment in markets or in your career, in your life, that has changed the way that you think about uncertainty? Amy, let's start with you.
Sure. Yeah. So I think for me, it probably was the COVID-19 pandemic, which I'm sure wouldn't shock anyone because obviously it was really uncertain times for all of us. But also at the beginning of 2020, I just moved across into the fund management team. So it was my first kind of like hands-on experience of learning how to manage portfolios, pretty much just as COVID broke out. And so, that was, I guess, quite a wild time, but also a really valuable learning experience in regards to uncertainty. And I think one thing that really kind of struck me was that markets stabilized quite quickly, even though everything still felt quite uncertain and scary for us in our personal lives. And I think kind of the lesson there was that there can be a real dislocation between kind of human and emotional uncertainty and kind of financial markets. And I suppose what's happening is that markets are not necessarily moving on how bad things feel right now, but it's more about what's expected versus what's priced in. And so, yeah, I think the lesson for me there was to kind of really separate your emotions from real investment risk and try and focus less on the headlines and focus more on changes to expectations.
Chris J.
So I'm going to go with one which is a bit older than that. I think I'm showing my age here. So I joined an asset management company, having previously worked in the public sector in 2007. That asset management company, in the space of the subsequent 2 years, went through a merger, a nationalisation, because the bank that it was part of was nationalised, and then a subsequent takeover. I think during 2009, I briefly technically became a member of the Belgian civil service. What would I say to that? I'd say that there's like the range of things that can happen is probably wider than the range of things that you expect to happen, even when you kind of try to consider that kind of full scenario set. So I think we're all kind of, you know, influenced by these sorts of formative experiences, but mine was very much one of pretty radical career uncertainty through the GFC.
Yeah, thank you. Chris?
I'm going to piggyback off a bit of both of those, actually. So I actually started work about 20 years ago. It was the week after Lehman Brothers went bankrupt. And obviously that threw kind of the financial market and our industry into kind of great uncertainty. The reality is I was probably a bit too junior, too naive to really realize what was going on, but the kind of fragility, panic, the mood of the kind of rest of my colleagues was quite evident. And so that set me up or framed my whole career in this kind of backdrop of relatively high uncertainty. But like I said, I was quite junior at the time. I just started work, so I didn't really have any involvement in decision making, and I just put my head down and managed to get on with it. So I fast forward from there to kind of Brexit as my first experience in a fund management role, you know, actually placing trades in portfolios, shaping their positioning, outcomes, etc., where I really had to deal with that uncertainty. So, and we saw with, you know, Brexit, we did our analysis. We're going to talk later about, you know, preparation and scenario analysis. We'd done that. We'd looked at the different outcomes we might see, yet it still felt like a genuine shock. And I think most people were quite surprised by the result. And we saw that in markets as well, because if it was an expected result, you wouldn't see big outcomes in markets, big changes. But the way that pound sterling weakened so much against other currencies clearly showed how much this was kind of an unexpected result. But then you go back to portfolios, and we prepared our portfolios to kind of weather that, and the kind of foreign currency risk that we had in the portfolios actually gained or contributed to positive performance in the fund. So it was a good example, really, of that method of preparing for different outcomes. Mm-hmm. Even if you get one that you don't expect, you can still get, you know, better outcomes for portfolios.
Great. Thank you all of that for sharing. So let's go to markets first. So, Chris, the narrative that uncertainty is an all-time high is a fixture of global commentary these days. How accurate is that statement and what do the data actually show?
So I think we can be quite definitive here. Like, that statement is nonsense. I cannot believe that geopolitical uncertainty, even though it feels pretty visceral today, is higher than during the Cuban Missile Crisis when the people involved were genuinely thought they were 24 hours away from Armageddon. I can't believe that economic and market uncertainty is genuinely higher today than in October 1987 when the markets crashed 20% in a single day. So where has this kind of narrative come from? I think, one, it's self-serving from people who are kind of in the commentary business to describe the market as and the outlook as more uncertain than ever has been before. Kind of absolves them from some responsibility when their forecasts are inevitably found out. And then partly it's a recency bias. So a recency bias is everywhere. Studies will show that the last 5 minutes of this podcast will capture people's attention in the way that the rest of it won't. So, you know, last 5 minutes better be good, guys. And my favorite one is in the Eurovision Song Contest, the singers coming last tend to get higher scores statistically than the singers at the beginning because they're the ones that the judges remember. So that recency bias in markets means that we just overemphasize the recent past relative to the kind of longer sweep of history.
You sent me an article a couple of weeks ago on news flow as well, specifically in financial markets. I'd looked at studies of news in general and how you get roughly 10 times more negative news than positive news. And Chris sent me a kind of follow-on to that, which is in financial markets in particular. And it looked at an index of how equity markets perform, but only on the days where it appears in the evening news, in the kind of the main evening news of each kind of each nation's main broadcaster. And what it showed was that as the normal index on an everyday basis kind of rose quite steadily, only the days where it fell dramatically did it get news coverage. And if you tracked an index of the performance of the equities in that country on the days it was reported in the news, you saw kind of persistent downward drag of equity market returns, which just didn't mirror kind of reality of this slow kind of upward grind. And it's that kind of behavioral bias, this kind of reporting on negative news events, which is pretty pervasive and makes everything feel uncertain, makes everything feel kind of quite scary.
Yeah, I mean, FTSE 100 up marginally is never going to be the front page news.
Exactly.
Right? FTSE 100 crashes.
Yeah.
Suddenly it's everywhere.
So, Amy, what exactly is going on in investors' minds here, though? So, and how are you having client conversations?
So I think, you know, obviously our clients are reading the same financial news as us and, you know, quite understandably, I think, quite concerned about some of these headlines and what does that actually mean for portfolios? And I think we're also getting a sense of kind of like headline fatigue and almost like a numbing to geopolitical risk. And I think that's because it just feels like it's kind of just like one thing after the other. And we've seen that markets can be quite resilient to geopolitical shocks. And so from our perspective with clients, I think it's really important for us to be able to distinguish kind of between the headline noise and what's really going to have fundamental impacts and really help kind of unpick that with our clients. And especially in these kind of scenarios where there's a lot of uncertainty and volatility, we want to be visible and available to do that with clients. But I think it's also equally important to bring clients back to their objectives and think, you know, what are these portfolios designed to do? And back to kind of how you described it earlier, you know, uncertainty isn't, you know, the enemy. It's more kind of how we behave and how we emotionally behave around that can actually be where the problem lies. So I think it's just important to remind our clients that we've constructed portfolios that are there to kind of absorb uncertainty rather than completely eliminate it. And so that really helps us move the conversation on from how do we avoid the next headline to how do we remain robust regardless of that headline.
Thank you. Chris, you've written about reckless prudence, and that's a provocative idea. So can you talk about a little bit what that means and how being too cautious can actually be genuine risk?
Yeah, absolutely. So reckless prudence is a term that we do like to use, and actually it always does get a reaction from clients as well. So the idea here is that by constantly reducing your risk, by hedging these potentially kind of negative or scary scenarios ahead of you. You're actually undermining your ability to generate returns and meet the objectives of your investment portfolio. And again, it's a behavioral bias, I think. So it's easy, it's comfortable, it feels disciplined, shall we say, to take risk off the table when there's a risky scenario ahead of you. There's an event risk that could damage portfolio returns. And so you take exposure off the table, or you put in a hedging position, or some other form of risk management. And it's easy to justify to your clients as well. Most of the time, it'll sound quite smart. But the reality is, if you keep doing that and you keep taking that risk off the table, you're not going to be taking enough risk to earn returns. And ultimately, that's what investors are compensated for. The fact that there is uncertainty means that there's a risk premium in markets. That means that we earn a return for taking these investments. And so if you stop taking them or keep lowering your exposures, keep lowering the amount of risk you're taking, it's going to be very hard to meet your return objectives in the long run. And so that's what we'd call reckless prudence, being too prudent to still be able to meet your objectives.
If you think about kind of like long-term studies of equity, bond, and bill returns. I mean, the most extreme version of this is just go to cash. Like, long-term bill returns are zero in real terms. So, yes, yeah, you've got preservation of capital.
And the drawdown is still zero as well. Yeah, so it looks appealing on that short-term basis. Yeah, but then if you look those same studies, look at your returns for 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, 30 years, and you see a pretty consistent pattern that the lower the risk of the instrument you're investing in, the lower your chances of beating inflation, and the higher the risk you're taking in some instruments like equities. Yes, you can get drawdowns on a one-year basis, but the higher your chances of producing the returns in the long term.
So, Chris J., can you build a little bit on what Chris T. has said? Investors face a fundamental choice, hedge or harvest. Can you walk us through that decision?
I think Chris has actually already spoken to most of it. I'd say a couple of things. So there are those kind of studies that I was previously alluding to about very long-term returns. But also, if you look at studies of short-term returns, it's interesting that most of the historical returns to equities, most of the historical returns to fixed income tend to accrue during the periods where volatility is high, where market perceptions of risk are high. So ultimately, if we kind of have a kind of conceptual model of how asset prices work, if there were no risk, everything would give us the same return as investing in cash. So it can be very tempting to hedge the risks, but if you deploy a strategy which makes your risks more cash-like, your returns are going to become more cash-like. I think there's also something about kind of the aggregation here, that sort of a diversification point, that over any individual decision, it may be the appropriate thing, given your risk tolerance, to hedge that risk. But you should be thinking about that not as one decision, but as one of many. And diversifying across those many decisions, clearly taking the exposure becomes something that is less concentrated than just thinking about it as a one-off thing.
Yeah, so it's kind of time diversification in that sense as well, right? It's you only face one or two events in each time period, but most investors are going to be here for 30 years. And so you're going to face many events. And the reality is that most risks don't play out as badly as the kind of the worst case scenario suggests. And most risks are averted in reality and don't cause drawdowns to your portfolios. So yes, individual ones may cause points of pain, but diversification of across time, across all of those events over many years is kind of rewarded. Yeah.
So, I really think there's kind of two questions that people should be asking when thinking about this. It's, is the risk tolerable to my portfolio? And I think that's the prepare point. There may be risks which are so existential and your portfolio is positioned in such a way that is not tolerable, and therefore action in advance becomes appropriate. And is the risk compensated? And that second one is a very hard thing sufficiently compensated. And that is a very hard thing to judge. But by the time that you start worrying about a market risk, it's very, very unlikely that other people aren't worrying about it as well. So it's likely to be the case that compensation has picked up. Now, equities will be weaker when there's a risk event on the horizon. Credit spreads will be wider when there's a risk event on the horizon. And it's our job to be judging, is that movement in prices sufficient in terms of having built up an increased risk premium that running that risk is a sensible thing to do. And then that's the harvest side, that there may be case examples where the market, we believe, is kind of overshot in terms of its assessment of that particular risk, and the compensation is then sufficient to take it.
I'd add number three to that.
Well, no.
Is it kind of tolerable? Is it compensated? Three is like, is it actually predictable? Do you have any edge over anyone else to predict the outcomes? And most of the time the case is that you don't have a significant reason to believe you can predict it better than anyone else. Even if you knew the geopolitical event that was going to occur, it's then even harder to predict what the actual market outcome is going to be. And whilst that's our role in some senses, and we kind of try and skew our probabilities in funds which are more kind of dynamic, shall we say, most of the time we've got to acknowledge that we can't really predict the outcome, let alone the market kind of impact as well.
And I was going to say, I think that's particularly true when it comes to thinking about geopolitical stuff. So, you know, what is our ability to, you know, read the mind of the one or two individuals who are ultimately making these decisions? It's pretty limited. And then kind of making decisions based on, I think President Trump will do X, Y, Z, or President Putin will do X, Y, Z, is a pretty kind of low value statement, because none of us know what he's thinking, they're thinking.
So, Amy, that tension between doing something and doing nothing, how are you navigating that conversation with clients?
Yeah, so I think it's really natural that clients want to feel reassured that we are managing portfolios and managing the risk. You know, no one wants to be sleepwalking into that next big financial crisis. But at the same time, I think it's equally important to focus on the fact that what we're not doing is kind of short-term risk-on-risk-off decisions. For example, at the moment, we're not buying or selling energy stocks based on the oil price volatility. But what we are doing is focusing on what we think could structurally change and have impacts on fundamentals. So we want to trace the transition mechanisms. For example, what do we think could happen to inflation or corporate earnings or default risks, and how might that feed through to bond yields or equity prices? And so I think it's really important to explain that to clients and focus on the fact that quite often kind of doing nothing isn't always, well, it's rarely ever doing nothing. It's actually an active decision in itself. And we have actually taken action. And the action is building portfolios that are resilient and robust and are diversified across many different risks. So I think that really helps clients accept our process and, you know, stay invested, because that's often over the long term how you're going to be able to meet your objectives.
Do you think there's something different about the way that these kind of geopolitical risks get thought about by clients relative to, I don't know, a common or garden, there's a recession risk or there's a kind of market drawdown risk? Do they think about them differently?
I think quite often people think, oh, this is different. Maybe because each of them are different in the topic, whereas, you know, a recession is a recession, like there's a definition for that, right? So maybe it grabs headlines and attention more than it should do.
Yeah, maybe that's kind of like, there's a template, I guess, as well, like during an average recession, there's an average drawdown of whatever, whereas this feels a bit more unanchored.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's just trying to bring people back to, there is a process and we can apply this to the different risks.
Well, I think in the kind of client context as well, industry feels to me like it's evolved over the nearly 20 years I've been in it, that we've moved in general away from the kind of more star fund manager approach where they're taking discretionary views based on their latest opinions to something that is more documented, more process driven, more driven by teams and investment philosophy as a whole. And I think that message is starting to sink in with a lot of clients, and they kind of do understand that that's the approach we're trying to take. And I don't think that's necessarily kind of unique at all. That's why I say the industry has evolved. A lot of asset managers have evolved that way, to be more kind of, well, both team orientated, but like I said, much more process orientated and able to tell you in advance how they're going to try and manage through scenarios like this as well.
Because, Jay, but clients do want a view. They want to know what's going on. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about forecasting and what are the limits here?
So we know that the empirical record here is that forecasters tend to get themselves in most trouble when they have the most confidence in what they're saying. That when it comes to either asking the general public kind of questions about general knowledge or asking market strategists, economists, commentators views about specific market variables, when they say they don't really know, they tend to be roughly correct in that calibration. When they say they're 90 to 95% certain, historically, they've only been right 50 to 60% of the time. And that's really dangerous because it's kind of those perceived certainties that end up being found out that can lead to the really discontinuous moves in prices. There's a Mark Twain quote, which I'm undoubtedly going to butcher, which I think is like really helpful here. It's not what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so. And I think that is how I would think about this issue. Be very, very careful about where people say, this is going to happen and I have a high degree of confidence in it. How well have they really calibrated that statement?
Yeah, that's making those statements that gets the headlines, which goes back to what we were saying at the beginning, right? Kind of headline risk and making big statements is what people see and in some cases kind of expect as well. I mean, we get these questions quite often. You know, how many rate cuts do you expect this year from the Federal Reserve or the Bank of England? And for us, it's, you know, not a case of predicting whether it's going to be two or three. It's kind of saying, well, right now the market's pricing maybe two or three. What's kind of interesting is whether the skew of risks is going to be significantly one side or the other side of that. And today's kind of oil price spike is a very good example of that, where 3-4 weeks ago, people were quite confidently saying, yeah, we'll get two rate cuts. And now oil prices are up. There's inflationary pressures. Those rate cuts have been priced out of the market. And those statements from 3-4 weeks ago were kind of relatively useless. Whereas we'd have thought, you know, it's not that we predicted this would happen, but we'd have said something more along the lines of the market's base case is something like 2 to 3 rate cuts. But these are the scenarios that could cause either much more or much kind of fewer rate cuts. And what does that mean for different asset classes? How should we position for that? And what are the signals that we should look for to kind of change our view on those things and hence potentially change positioning in portfolios? So it's one of our least favorite questions when a client asks us, how many rate cuts are you going to get this year?
So investors only see one path, but they have to prepare for many then. So that raises a question about regret. How do you make peace with that? And what's the real risk of hindsight bias? Chris Jay?
Well, Hindsight Capital, the institution that can always invest based on what has happened, makes a lot of money every year. But nobody can invest in hindsight. We have to invest in the here and now and looking forwards. So regret is a really kind of profoundly useless emotion in this kind of context. Like, but it's very hard to get away from. Like, who doesn't? I mean, even if we're not kind of thinking about sort of institutional basis, who doesn't regret not owning more NVIDIA stock over the last 5 years? Or who doesn't regret, you know, not being able to kind of capture the huge run-up in cryptocurrency, for example, if they have not participated in that? So that regret is very, very natural. But it's just not terribly useful. Yeah, I was on Mark Twain earlier. I guess I'm now going to be on Frank Sinatra. Regrets, we've had a few, but then again, too few to mention.
Amy, can you talk about the cost of diversification?
Yeah, so regret, I think, is a real cost of diversification, and we probably don't talk about it enough. And as Chris has said, it is very natural, and I think it can feel uncomfortable, but it's part of being invested in a robust strategy. And so I think it's important to kind of recognize that when we're talking with our clients. And I think one way of thinking about it is that if you're invested in a really well diversified strategy, you're not going to have a huge exposure to the worst performing assets, which is, you know, our goal. It's what we want to do. But equally, you're not going to have a really concentrated exposure to the best performing assets. And that's by design. So we think having really strong investment beliefs that are very well articulated and documented, it helps us kind of trust the process and remain invested. And I think also helps us explain that to our clients so that they can navigate that regret risk as well. And also with their end clients too. And so, yeah, I think that helps move the conversation away from the hindsight bias and what could I have been invested in to yeah, staying the course, essentially.
Being in diversified portfolios means you're never going to get to the end of the year and have the best returns. That's just never going to happen. Equally, and that might make you kind of upset, but equally, you know you're not going to get to the end of the year and have the worst returns either. And that's really kind of the plan, is to kind of narrow the range of outcomes, have a more secure kind of a set of portfolio returns for any given level of risk, really. But yeah, like I said, the regret part is that there's always going to be someone who's going to have done better than you, because they're going to be more concentrated in the one or two things that have done really well.
And you can see this with the way that people talk about US equities in the last 18 months, I think. You kind of go back to 18 months ago, and there was a lot of regret from people who didn't own more of the US mega cap stocks that had outperformed a lot over the course of multiple years. Wind the clock forward to today, and people are having very different conversations about how comfortable I am. Am I with US dollar exposure? How comfortable am I with the amount of US equity exposure that's implicit in any kind of global market cap weighted approach? And it's really just performance that's triggered that, you know, we've gone through an 18-ish month period in which US equities have been underperforming relative to other markets, and people think about that differently. But I'm saying, like, the regret that they felt 18 months ago is just as sort of unhelpful as the regret they might feel today.
Okay, so last question in one sentence, what do you want listeners to walk away with today?
I'll go first on that. I think I'll take, reckless prudence. I mentioned it earlier, but that constantly taking risk off the table is going to mean that your portfolio is unlikely to meet the return objectives that you have in the long run.
And I'm going to go with illusion of knowledge and recency bias. So we all think we know more than we do, and we all overweight the very recent past.
And I would kind of build on that and say that good investing isn't about predicting the future. It's not a prediction game, but it's more about building a strategy that can navigate it.
So prepare, don't predict. Thank you, Amy, Chris, and Chris. Thank you. It's been a genuinely thoughtful conversation, and I hope it gives our listeners a practical way to reframe how they think about uncertainty in their portfolios. The team has written a series of blogs on the topic of prepare, don't predict, so links to those can be found in the show notes. Thank you for listening to LNG Talks, and we'll be back next week with a new episode.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. The views expressed in this podcast are those of L&G's Asset Management Division, as at the date of publication. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and we're not soliciting any action based on it. The information discusses general market, economic or political issues, or industry or sector trends. It does not constitute research or investment, legal or tax advice. It is not recommendation or advertisement to buy or sell securities or pursue a particular investment strategy. Assumptions, opinions, and estimates are provided for illustrative purposes only. There is no guarantee that any forecast made will come to pass. No party shall have any right of action against L&G in relation to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Where this podcast contains third-party information, the accuracy or completeness of such information cannot be guaranteed, and we accept no responsibility or liability in respect of such information, not for distribution to any person in any jurisdiction where such distribution would be contrary to local law or regulations. Copyright 2025. Legal and General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Unless otherwise stated, references herein to L&G, we and us are meant to capture the global conglomerate that includes, in the European Economic Area, LGIM Managers Europe Limited, authorised and regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland as a UCITS management company pursuant to European Communities Undertaking for Collective Investment in Transferable Securities Regulations 2011 as amended, and as an Alternative Investment Fund Manager pursuant to the European Union Alternative Investment Fund Managers Regulations 2013 as amended. In the USA, Legal and General Investment Management America, Inc., a US SEC regulated investment advisor. In Japan, Legal and General Investment Management Japan, KK, a Japan FSA registered investment management company. In Hong Kong, issued by Legal and General Investment Management Asia Limited, which is licensed by the Securities and Futures Commission. And in Singapore, issued by LGIM Singapore Pte Limited, company registration number 20223187 6W, which is regulated by the Monetary Authority of Singapore. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on LinkedIn or on our website.